and Prince and Perry. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled The Awkward Adolescence of a Media Revolution. This was written by Jessica Yellen. There's a quiet revolution in how millions of Americans decide what's real. Trust is slipping away from traditional institutions, media, government, and higher education, and shifting to individual voices online, among them social media creators. The Reuters Institute reports that this year, for the first time, more Americans will get their news from social and video platforms, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, and X, than from traditional outlets. According to Pew Research, one in five adults now regularly turns to influencers for news. For anyone who cares about credible information, this is a potentially terrifying prospect. Social media rewards virality, not veracity. Spend 5 minutes scrolling TikTok or Instagram, and you might encounter influencers educating you about a global elite running the world from hidden continents beneath an ice wall in Antarctica, or extolling the virtues of zeolite, a volcanic binder for mold that will vacuum clean all kinds of toxins to lift brain fog, prevent cancer, or remove microplastics from testicles. Link to purchase in bio. It's an environment perfectly engineered to scale both misinformation and slick grifts. Yet the popular notion that social media is just a dumpster fire of viral lies misses something vital. Millions of people still care about truth. They are seeking facts on social media from credible voices they can trust. They just aren't always sure where to find them or from whom. I know because I interact with these people every day. I was among the first independent journalists to bring news reporting to Instagram. Today, my outlet, News Not Noise, spans Instagram, YouTube, a podcast, Substack, and other platforms. In my years of directly engaging with an on-platform audience, the question I receive more than any other remains simply, is it true? I'm here to tell you that truth isn't dead. Thousands of people like me operate online as what I call evidence-based creators. We're journalists and specialists who use expertise, original reporting, and reliable sources to refute misinformation, add context to breaking news, and answer the endless questions flooding our DMs. The topics we cover range from redistricting to medical misinformation, beauty fads, to whether that viral health food trend might actually kill you. The work is an uphill battle. My cohort is not John Oliver-level media personalities with PR teams, production crews, and a research staff to fact-check the punchlines. We are independent voices operating without safety nets. I like to think of us as the digital equivalent of artisanal chefs working in a factory for mass-produced junk food. The very things that make us valuable, our obsession with facts, our commitment to nuance, our hours spent answering audience questions in the apps, put us at a profound disadvantage in the attention economy. What does it take to produce a slick video claiming that beef tallow is nature's Viagra? 15 minutes with an iPhone and zero regard for reality. While we're still sourcing assertions and trying to make complex ideas both accurate and engaging, the bullshit factory has already pumped out six more viral falsehoods. Our secret weapon isn't production value or algorithm hacking. It's trust. When I debunk a viral lie, I'm not a faceless institution. I'm the person who's been with my audience while they brush their teeth every morning, the person who's been in their ears during commutes, the person whose face they've studied through hundreds of 90-second windows into complex issues. This isn't an audience of passive consumers. They're hungry for more. More reporting on more topics, more conversations with experts, more explanations that break things down but don't treat an audience like idiots. Can the Supreme Court disbar an attorney? Will the military disobey unconstitutional orders? Do I need another measles vaccine as an adult? All of this leaves evidence-based creators in a strange limbo. We're clearly valued. Substack, for instance, is proving that audiences are willing to stop scrolling and financially support verifiers they trust. But we're still largely disconnected from the resources and collaborative frameworks that could multiply our impact. We're working so hard at the work itself that we have little opportunity to build the scaffolding required to create a durable new model in digital publishing, one that includes tools such as high-powered marketing and growth engines to reach new audiences, editorial oversight to help with difficult judgment calls, and shared research that would prevent each of us from having to build expertise from scratch with every breaking story. I see this obstacle as an opportunity. History shows us that industries facing technological disruption tend not to simply collapse. They transform. Look at what happened to the music industry when Spotify and its streaming cohort crashed the party. In the old days, musicians lived and died by album sales and radio play, with major labels acting as gatekeepers. Then streaming blew the doors off. The revolution was messy. Many artists found themselves with more listeners than ever, but paychecks that wouldn't cover a month's worth of ramen. What helped the music industry find its footing wasn't nostalgia for CDs or vinyl. It was new infrastructure, playlist curation that helped listeners find their next obsession, analytics tools that told artists who was actually listening, distribution services that got music onto platforms, and business models that went beyond streaming royalties to include direct-to-fan revenue and merchandising. Artists still face challenges, but now labels are investing heavily in data to understand trends, offering artists different types of deals, and using their marketing muscle to help artists cut through the digital noise. The industry evolved by creating tools that complemented streaming algorithms instead of fighting them, helping artists understand their audiences instead of just praying for a decent playback placement. In our current information ecosystem, we're stuck in the awkward adolescence of a media revolution. The need for innovation couldn't be more urgent. Local newspapers are dying like mall food courts. 2,500 plus have shut down since 2005. Traditional media outlets are under assault by the Trump administration. And AI is flooding us with convincing fake content, making human truth tellers all the more necessary. Conversations about the press and the tech revolution often get stuck on the problems with or the inadequacy of any solution. It's time that changed. So I'll take the leap and propose some imperfect innovations. First, audiences could benefit from an independent, off-platform certification system to help them discern which independent voices adhere to journalistic standards. Not to be all papers please about it, but audiences need signals about who's committed to accuracy versus who's just chasing likes. One solution, a nonprofit voluntary opt-in lead type certification that awards something like a blue check mark, but vetted far more rigorously, to creators who use agreed-upon trusted sources, check their facts, and reveal when their content is sponsored. I'm aware that any credentialing system risks backlash from those suspicious of gatekeeping, but people shouldn't be disparaged for doing their own research if they aren't offered the tools to tell reality from fiction. Second, evidence-based creators need support. Imagine a fractional ownership model where like-valued creators buy into a shared professional framework. With an economy of scale, we could collectively share in things such as legal protection and sophisticated audience development tools designed specifically for evidence-based content. We could sign sponsors who understand the unique value of trusted voices. We could offer bundled subscriptions to help audiences find more of us at once. This could create sustainable revenue streams without compromising integrity. Finally, legacy media, please stop viewing creators as a threat. We don't have to be competitors. We can be the connective tissue between trusted journalism and the platforms where people now consume most of their information. Traditional media outlets can stay relevant in the new digital reality by partnering with us. But first, it would help if they'd allow for the possibility that what's happening isn't just the death of an old system. It's the messy, complicated birth of a new one. And like a newborn, it needs more than good intentions in order to thrive. The author Jessica Yellen is the former chief White House correspondent for CNN, in addition to being the founder of www.newsnotnoise.com. The second story, Captain Ron's Guide to Fearless Flying. Could Captain Ron cure my fear of flying? This is written by Elaine Godfrey. On a hot Saturday evening in May, I reported to Terminal 4 of Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport. There, in a small conference room behind an unmarked door, I put on a name tag and joined 18 other nervous-looking people, hoping to be cured by Captain Ron. Captain Ron, real name Ron Nielsen, is a 78-year-old former commercial pilot who teaches a free class for nervous flyers roughly once a month. He has the wholesome look of a small-town minister, rectangular glasses, short-cropped white hair, and a whimsical tuft sticking out of each nostril. He's like the aviation equivalent of Rick Steves, the kind of guy who, after a class that goes particularly well, exclaims, "It should be against the law to have that much fun." A fear of flying, Captain Ron explained, is nothing to be ashamed of. You're not broken. The anxiety looks different for different people. Some worry mostly about external factors, such as crashes and terrorism. Others dread a panic attack and how fellow passengers might react to it. Sitting next to me was a retiree named Mike, who had been coming to Captain Ron's class regularly to address his claustrophobia ahead of a long-anticipated flight, a two-hour trip to Reno to visit his grandson. Across the table, Stephanie and her husband, whom she'd brought along for moral support, were planning a trip to Cambodia. "Over water," someone across the room offered. Stephanie's eyes were wide. We understood completely. Lots of people suffer from a fear of flying, including at least 25 million of us in the United States, according to the Cleveland Clinic. Our worries are often dismissed as irrational. Planes are much safer than cars, etc. But a recent succession of terrifying airplane incidents has only seemed to validate our phobia, most notably the crash landing of the Air India Dreamliner that killed 241 people on board in early June, which came just a few months after the mid-air collision that killed 67 people near my home airport just outside Washington, D.C. Recent events notwithstanding, most aviation fears boil down to a lack of control. Elaine Iljohn Foreman, a clinical psychologist and co-author of Fly Away Fear, told me, Sometimes these fears are triggered or exacerbated by a specific flying experience or major life changes. Alex, a 42-year-old IT manager who sat near me in class, said that he developed his fear of flying when his wife was pregnant with their twins. The couple were forced to fly twice from Phoenix to Los Angeles for medical care to save the pregnancy. And for Alex, it was a traumatic experience. I'd experienced 21 years of unmemorable flights before my own fear of flying took hold. In May of 2015, I was traveling from my home state of Iowa to New York City for a summer internship. I was already nervous about moving, and then, somewhere above Illinois, the plane hit a patch of turbulence and dropped what I felt like 1,000 feet. Several people screamed. For the first time in my life, I began to experience what I would later understand to be panic. My face and neck went clammy, and black spots filled my vision. At one point, an overhead bin popped open, and a few unbuckled passengers smacked their head on the ceiling. They were all okay, and physically so was I. But I had unlocked a new fear. I'd been a white-knuckle flyer ever since. Upon boarding, I proceeded down the aisle like a bride heading to a doomed marriage, quietly assessing my fellow passengers for trustworthiness. Should a crash require us to forge a Lost-style alliance of survivors? At the first bump, my palms start to sweat and my calf muscles tighten. In particularly rough air, when the pilot urges the flight attendants to please take their seats, I begin to administer my own last rites. "You've had a good run," my brain whispers, and fire off a few farewell notes to loved ones. "Really bad up here," I text to my boyfriend. "Love you." Once, on my way to a friend's wedding, I was so overcome with anxiety that I passed out at the gate, my body folding over my suitcase like a wilted flower. For a while, I considered a flightless future, but the cost was too high. I remembered Royce White, the Iowa State basketball player, whose fear of flying required him to drive hundreds of miles to away games and contributed to the end of his NBA career. I thought of a longtime family friend named Betty, whose aerophobia I had always interpreted as an abiding love for trains. Betty regularly traveled between Iowa and Florida via Amtrak sleeper car, a journey that took 96 hours, required layovers in Chicago and D.C., and cost approximately $4,000. I've kept flying, but many of the others in Captain Ron's class hadn't. Alex had flown only once since his wife gave birth. Mike, the claustrophobic retiree, told me that on a recent attempt to fly, he took an Ambien and drank a few shots of whiskey, yet he remained too terrified to board. Tired and tipsy, he had to call his daughter for a ride home. The main portion of Captain Ron's class took place on a stationary Southwest airplane. After introductions, he handed out boarding passes bearing our names, but no destination. And together we marched warily through the ticketing area, from the ticketing area through security. At gate D13, a Southwest agent led us down the jet bridge and onto a waiting Boeing 737 MAX 8 and, once we were seated, made a formal boarding announcement. "Good evening and welcome aboard Southwest Airlines Flight 1234 with service to nowhere." For the next hour, Captain Rod stood in the aisle and delivered a lecture that flitted between airplane trivia and personal anecdotes. We learned how much time is generally required for a plane to become airborne, 35 to 45 seconds, and how much fuel planes typically carry for domestic flights, more than enough to get to their destination. We were reminded that turbulence, while unpleasant, is not dangerous. We learned about strategies for overpowering our emotional elephant brain with our logical rider brain. If you needed an actionable task to distract ourselves during takeoff, Captain Ron suggested journaling about our anxiety or quizzing a travel companion with rapid-fire math problems. Together, we inhaled for 4 seconds and exhaled for 6. Sometimes we learned it helps to breathe through a straw. Very little seemed to crack Captain Ron's cheery exterior, including questions about the recent air travel incidents. Newark Airport had just experienced a brief radar blackout, and on the same day our class was held, the aviation hub was having air traffic control staffing issues. A student asked Captain Ron whether people should be worried. Great one," he said. "Airports," he explained, "reduce the number of planes in the air if there aren't enough controllers to keep people flying safely." A few days after our class, NBC News reported that, according to an anonymous Newark air traffic controller, the airport had lost radio contact with pilots multiple times in recent months. "I can't tell you that that's a desirable situation," Captain Ron told me by phone, "but pilots have procedures for this." After an hour together on the plane, we disembarked and took a group photo at the entrance to the jet bridge. A few of my classmates would be back in a month to commune again with other anxious flyers and spend another hour on a plane, hearing Captain Ron's soothing words. For some, just sitting on that grounded plane is a form of exposure therapy. I wished I could join them. The irony was not lost on me that attending my fear of flying class required taking 2 long plane rides. But the next morning, I was feeling confident and decided to forego my usual Xanax before the flight home. Captain Ron had advised me to try boarding early to meet the pilots, something I had assumed only a child could do. In the cockpit, I told the captain and first officer that I hated turbulence. "That's what everybody seems to be afraid of," the captain said, laughing. "It's never caused a problem." I smiled politely. The first officer explained that he often falls asleep when he flies as a passenger, and I wake up when we touch down. Very helpful. At my seat, I focus on Captain Ron's actionable tasks. I timed our takeoff, which took exactly 40 seconds. I journaled my feelings and listened to an audio recorded created by Captain Ron called Harmonizer, a 32-minute cacophony of sounds and hypnotic phrases meant to desensitize and distract your brain. "No more fears, no more suffering," Captain Ron says on the recording. "I've had it, and now I'm changing. Today's the day." For a more absorbing diversion, I watched a few episodes of a smutty Netflix drama about British prep schoolers. Halfway through the flight, the plane hit a rough patch, and my skin grew clammy. What if I had distracted the pilots from their pre-flight checklist? Soon there was a new bout of bumps, this time bigger. My chest tightened, and I tried to breathe in for 4 seconds and out for 6. I thought of one of my classmates, Irene, who told me she practices accepting her lack of control by reminding herself that the universe does what it's going to do. I tried to achieve a similar state of acceptance. After a few minutes, my heartbeat slowed. The flight turned out to be one of my bumpiest and therefore most unpleasant in recent memory. Captain Ron had not fixed me. But I was a slightly different flyer. I had learned some new tools for managing my fear, and I'd come to view that fear as something other than shameful, a shameful secret. Yes, I'd been anxious, but I had flown to Arizona. I had eaten carne asada, hiked the Big Butte Loop, and laughed at the name Big Butte Loop. I had faced my discomfort and boarded the plane anyway. A few days after I returned to D.C., my classmate Alex was set to fly to Chicago with his family, his first airplane trip in years. I texted him the night before to say that I was thinking of him. When I didn't hear back, I was worried that his fear had once again gotten in the way. Then, late the following afternoon, I received a text. It was a picture of distant red sandstone hills. Phoenix's Papago Park from a tiny airplane window. We have some time left for a Dear James letter. Dear James, I miss playing the banjo. And this is by James Parker. Dear James, I have one of those eternal questions, the kind that is difficult to answer no matter how much you ruminate on it. How exactly is one supposed to work hard enough to put food on the table and also not work so hard as to abhor your day-to-day existence? What I'm getting at is I used to play the banjo. I used to be pretty good, too. I'd go down to the local bar every month or so, sit around with the others, and make some real music for hours at a time. The average passerby might not have paid to hear it. But we always had a good crowd in the place. Sometimes they'd even sing along, and I have only fond memories of the whole thing. But alas, I'm a student. I have a couple of licensing exams coming up that I can't afford to fail. Of course, if I had my ducks in a row, I could contrive to both study for my licensing exams and play my banjo. People do harder things, but I don't have my ducks in a row, so it's one or the other. Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Does careerism require the soul in exchange for success? Maybe I just need to get those ducks in a row. Dear reader, dude, if I may, play your banjo. Nothing is more important than playing your banjo. There are plenty of hours in the day. Get your ducks in a row and then behead the ducks. Play your banjo. James. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.